We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.
Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission. Welcome to the Wheat All About It podcast. Wheat is a miracle plant, and if you're interested in wheat and the forces that affect the wheat industry, then you've come to the right place. Wheat All About It includes interviews, presentations, and yes, even my own musings about our favorite crop. And please, visit our Facebook page where I will post items including photographs of speakers, PowerPoint slides from presentations, as well as information about contests. Search for Wheat All About It! And now, here we are at episode 4 and what I'm calling the Charlie Plum story. Let's go back nearly 50 years ago. 24-year-old Charlie Plum was 5 days from going home in 1967 on his 75th mission over North Vietnam when a surface-to-air missile shot down his F-4 Phantom jet. He ejected and parachuted into enemy hands. He spent the next 2,103 days in a North Vietnamese prison. Plum's talk at the Tri-State Wheat Convention began in a darkened hall with only the sound of pacing. 3 steps, pause, and then 3 more steps. When the lights came up, Plum was walking back and forth within the outline of what was his prison cell for almost 6 years. 8 feet by 8 feet, it allowed him just enough room for 3 steps in one direction before turning around. Plum told his audience of wheat farmers, their spouses, and agribusiness representatives that many of the same challenges people face in daily life are like those he faced in a prison cell, and the recipe of responses are not dissimilar either. Because in the end, the mental boxes, what he called the 8 inches between our ears, can be more restrictive than any prison. The theme of Plum's talk revolved around what he called parachute packing, a topic on his mind since he ran into a sailor several years ago who packed his parachute, the one that opened and allowed him to survive after ejecting from his fighter jet. Plum believes there's all kinds of parachutes that allowed him to survive 6 years in captivity that allow all of us to survive.
Well, you see, I grew up in a tiny town in Kansas, Lecompton, Kansas, a town of some 325 souls and a couple of Presbyterians. I was a 4-H'er and a Boy Scout. A great childhood. We were rich. We were probably some of the richest people in that county. We didn't have any material wealth. We didn't have any money, but we were rich in family unity and love, and I had a great childhood, but I grew up in a 3-room house. Three rooms, not 3 bedrooms, 3 rooms total. In fact, I shared the only bedroom with my big sister and my 2 little brothers. In fact, I never slept alone until I got married. Some of you aren't laughing at that one. But I got had a lot of wonderful people there in that little town. And they packed my parachute. Now, don't miss this metaphor, okay? People gave of themselves, asking nothing in return, that I might be a better person and be able to make it through some tough times. And of course, mom and dad and preachers and teachers and a coach, I'll never forget the name Smith. If Clarence Smith were still alive, I would have called him this morning from Coeur d'Alene to thank that guy. He was a vet. He had shrapnel in one leg from his war. He coached a little basketball team there. We lost and lost and lost. Last game of the season, we lost again. Imagine one dejected 13-year-old lad wandering off to the locker room. Here comes the coach. He walked with a limp, but he caught up with me. And I felt his arm over my sweaty shoulder, and I looked at the coach, tough disciplinarian. All I could think of to say was, "I'm sorry, coach, I guess this team's just a bunch of losers." The coach squeezed my shoulder. He sunk his fingernails into the flesh. He said something I shall never forget. He said, "Son, whether you think you're a loser or whether you think you're a winner, you're right." I didn't understand that. I asked him the next day, "Coach, what did that mean?" He said, just this. He said, life is a choice. Every day of your life is going to be a beautiful choice. I don't care where you go. He said, I don't care what kind of a scrape you get yourself into someday. You can choose. You can choose happiness or sadness. You can choose a smile or a frown. You can choose profit or loss. You can choose health or sickness. You can choose life or death. He said, there's one more choice. When the going is tough and the margins are thin and the price of wheat's in $3 a bushel and your yields and 50 bushel an acre and the weather is coming in and your wife's upset and nothing's working for you and you want to quit, you can always choose to give away all those other choices. You can absolutely elect to step back and become the victim, or you can step forward and become the victor. It's your choice. Now, with that kind of inspiration and motivation, as you might suspect, I graduated from that little grade school top of my class of two. and the other guy wasn't all that bright. You know, you probably don't think about this much, but a speaker gets in trouble sometimes, you know, when you show up late and stuff. I was still living in Kansas, got a frantic call from Topeka, superintendent of schools. Said, "I have a big-time problem. Charlie, can you help me?" I said, "I'll try." "Well, I have this in-service meeting. I have 350 teachers, and my speaker just canceled." Breakneck speed, Topeka, Kansas. Jumped up on a stage just like this, facing 350 teachers. Started to tell my story. "Folks, you know, I grew up right down the river there in Lecompton, Kansas. In fact, I graduated in a little grade school top of my class of two." Some of them laughed. I said, "And the other guy wasn't all that bright." A few more of them laughed. I looked about halfway out in the crowd. Here's the number two guy. And he will not let me forget that. I don't know how smart you were at age 17. I was a hayseed from Kansas. I'd never been out of the four states of Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, and Oklahoma. I'd never seen the ocean. I'd never ridden in an airplane. What I did know at age 17 was I need an education. My parents couldn't afford to send me to college. I started looking for scholarships. I got an appointment to Annapolis. Unbelievable. I had no idea what they did in Annapolis. I got on that Greyhound bus, and 2 days later, as several of you in this room have done, I was pledging to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. What a commitment that was. And I had no idea what it was going to take to fulfill that commitment. Learned a lot there at the boat school. Learned to tie knots, send the Morse code, drive the ships around the Chesapeake Bay. Lucky for me, I got my parachute packed. People gave of themselves, asking nothing in return. See, that's one of the deals about parachute packing. It's not a trade, all right? It's not, hey, I'm going to do this for you if you'll do that for me. That's not it. Parachute packing is unconditional. It's a gift. And the parachute packers there were chaplains and other midshipmen and officers and professors and a superintendent who would stand up in front of the big pep rallies before the football games. This guy would clench his fists. You could see the veins running his brow. He would say, "You guys can do anything you set your minds to do." Was this hype? Was he messing with our minds? Mental manipulation? Did it work? Those 4 years, the Naval Academy took a ragtag football team and produced two Heisman Trophy winners in 4 years. We were the number two, then the number one college team in the nation for a little while. Best of all, Navy beat Army four times straight. This guy was right. We could, in fact, do anything we set our mind to do. Interesting stories there, Captain. What's it got to do in farming in these three states, anyway? What's that got to do with this meeting? Well, just this. I was empowered by both those guys, both the coach and the soup empowered me. They empowered me to win, which was beautiful, but more importantly, They empowered me to fail. Did you get that part? Life is a choice. You can do anything you set your mind to do. Those are positive or negative. You can take those issues either way. They empowered me to win. They empowered me to fail. Most importantly, they empowered me to make the choice.
Plum acknowledges that he thought he was hot stuff prior to being shot down. He didn't think of the people in the guts of the aircraft carrier, the Kitty Hawk, packing parachutes, and then...
74 successful combat missions, over 100 carrier landings, pretty well seasoned jet fighter pilot, and 5 days to go. Well, let me tell you about that day, the day I was shot down. Maybe you've had a day like this. Anybody? No, started out nice enough. Puffy clouds, blue sky, check this out. Look at this, 24 years old. In command of a multi-gazillion dollar jet fighter. See this hand? I have two throttles in this hand. I shove these throttles into the afterburners. I can go 1,400 miles an hour, and that's a long way from a John Deere. You see this finger? I pull the trigger on my control stick, release the missiles from underneath my wings. I can knock down enemy airplanes that I can't even see. I really am the top guy. I am the best of the best. Can anybody argue this point? I'm the guy that always stands tall. I'm the one that's never afraid. Hey, I'm probably bulletproof. How about it? Ever feel bulletproof? I don't know. I'm sure there are stories in this room of, lots of moisture late in the spring, and then it got really dry, and then you hit that early freeze in the winter, and everything you eat. Well, what do you do in those situations? You see, because I'm convinced that getting blown out of the sky can actually be good for you. So there we were, my co-pilot in my back seat and screaming along over enemy territory. Here comes a missile. It exploded to some 12,000 pounds of jet fuel we had in that airplane. Since that bird topsy-turvy, end over end down towards the rice paddy, I ejected. He ejected. Our parachutes opened, and we came floating down over enemy territory. Ever been in one of those parachutes? I don't mean the nylon ones. I'm talking about those parachutes of life. I'm talking about those fender benders that you and I get ourselves into once in a while. I'm talking about something as insignificant as being cut out of your lane on the highway, something as major as the loss of a child. But really, isn't that where your value lies? Let's try to measure it. Let's measure the value of you. Let's measure your value to your farm, to your operation, to your family, to your God. It can't be measured in the easy times. Anybody can show up. Your true value has to be measured when the heat's on, when things are tough. So how do you handle it? All I can tell you is how I handle it. I felt the opening shock of the parachute. As I had been trained to do as a fighter pilot, I immediately looked up and I counted the panels in my parachute. That technique is called assessing your support group. I look down at the unknown. They're shooting at me. The audacity of this enemy. They've just knocked down my multi-gazillion dollar jet fighter, and now they are shooting at the pilot. And I'll tell you this. Now, you can identify with this one. When you're dodging bullets, it's tough to come up with a long-range plan. So how do you handle it? I don't know how you handle it. All I can tell you is how I handle it. I took a deep breath, let about half of it out, bowed my head, and I said a prayer. I asked for a little extra strength that day from above. You know, I'll never forget that prayer. I thought about that prayer a lot over those next 6 years in those various prison cells that I was in. I thought back to that moment in time. I'm dangling in a parachute, and I would say to myself, well, dummy, why didn't you make a deal with God? You know, a promise to be a righteous, sober, godly guy the rest of my life. Lord, all I need from you is a little wind. 10, 12 mile an hour, gusting to 40, please. I guess I didn't feel in much of a negotiable position, so I just prayed for the guts it was going to take to survive.
He wasn't in his prison cell long before one of his fellow prisoners made contact using an ingenious method that allowed long, if laborious, conversations.
About 200 miles into my experience, I heard in the far corner the chirping noise of a cricket. I had been a farm kid and knew what a cricket sounded like, but the longer I listened, the more rhythmic this chirp became, and I thought, that's a pretty educated little critter. Maybe I can teach him to sing. I walked over to the corner of my prison cell and found there no cricket, but a little piece of wire about that long. Poked through a hole at the base of the cell wall and scratching on my concrete floor, making this chirping noise like a cricket. I'm watching the little wire and thinking to myself, there's got to be another American on the other end of that wire. The enemy's just not sophisticated enough to try to trick me. And boy, would I like to talk to another American. Because if it's an American, it's got to be a fighter pilot, since that's who's in these prison camps. It's an air war. We are being shot down. They're putting us in these camps. Boy, would I like to talk to another pilot. We could tell some stories. But I'll bet that guy's tougher than I am. I bet he didn't cry when they tortured him. I'm kind of losing interest now. You know, it'd be nice to talk to somebody about that big time problem. But hey, life's pretty short. Got other things to do. Anyway, if I can just roll over here in the corner and wait, surely in a few years the Marines will break down the gates and I'll be set free and I'll never have to take another risk. And the wire kept scratching and I kept sweating. And I finally got up the guts to reach down and grab that little wire and tug. And the wire tugged back. I tugged again and it disappeared right back through that rat hole. But the wire came back about an hour later. This time the wire had a note wrapped around the end of it. This note was written on a dirty piece of toilet paper, just blobs on this wadded up piece of toilet paper. I could barely make it out. But it said, memorize this code, then eat this note. I did it. I memorized the code. I ate the note. The code was a 5x5 box of the alphabet. 5 lines, 5 rows. A, B, C, D, E, then F, G, H, I, J. We left out K just to make it come out 5x5. Numbers down the side and across the top indicating any letter of the alphabet would be represented by 2 numbers. Number of the line, then the number of the row. Got it? A, first line, first row. 1 tug, 1 more tug. Z, fifth line. You think your email is cumbersome. You try this. But it worked. This silly, archaic, cumbersome code became our language. No more than that, it became our lifeblood. I mean, it was amazing how vital it was to communicate with another American. And the interesting part was, it wasn't the words. It wasn't the phrases or the sentences or the meaning. The vital part, the life and death part of communication in a prison camp and in your life is a simple validation of another human being. Because in those prison cells, when it was dark, as it was in a lot of the camps, and if we were alone in solitary confinement, you'd lose track. You wouldn't know what was a real memory, what was a hallucination. You need a baseline. You need to validate your sanity. Sometimes you wouldn't know if you were alive or dead. The simple tugging on a wire, and then have that wire tug back meant 2 things. Number 1, somebody's responding to something I am doing physically, thus I exist. Number 2, somebody cares. In this day and age, with our high technology, we figure the greatest achievement of all times, we can now pass a packet of data from one handheld machine around the world to another handheld machine. I would suggest to you that your very purpose in life is to validate other people. And so the old adage, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. On the other end of that wire, Lieutenant Commander Bob Shoemaker, fighter pilot extraordinaire, astronaut candidate. Better than that, here's a parachute packer. Funny how those parachute packers sort of slide out of the shadows of your life when you need them the most. He'd been there for 2 years. Shoemaker was one of the longest held prisoners in the Vietnam War. He was there over 8 years. And he'd been piecing together little bits of wire and stuffing them out a hole in his cell wall across a storeroom. There was a storeroom between our 2 prison cells. He fished that little wire over the boxes and around the shovels and through the ropes and into the little hole in my cell wall 14 feet away. Unbelievable. Just to contact another American. Just to pack my parachute. He said, "How you doing, buddy?" I said, "I'm doing terrible." "Buddy? My president sent me over here. It's his dirty Vietnam War, not mine. And the enemy's torturing prisoners. That's not fair. And it wasn't my private airplane I flew in here, you know. That was a U.S. government airplane. I'm just a victim of circumstances beyond my control." Shoemaker said, "You want to know your biggest problem?" I said, "You mean I have problems bigger than the ones I can see?" He said, "Sounds like you're suffering from a fairly common prison disease. A lot of guys get it. Some guys die from it." "Oh, man, what's the name of this disease?" He said, "Well, around here we just call it prison thinking." I said, "Prison thinking?" He said, "Roger, you think you are a prisoner." I'm thinking, what kind of nut did they put me next to? Look at this. I am bleeding from four open wounds. I have four holes in my body where blood's coming out. I have no medical care. I have big boils all over my face, all over the rest of my body. I'm down to about 115 pounds. My sole possession in life is a rag I have knotted around my waist to hide my nudity. Clearly, I'm rotting away in a communist prison camp. And now, to add insult to injury, they put me next to a positive thinker. I kept talking. I guess you're right. I guess I'm suffering from this disease of prison thinking. I said, "What's the antidote to my disease?" He said, "If you're going to survive this place," he said, "you got to have faith." He said, "I'm not a preacher. I'm not going to try to convert you to a religion." He said, "I've just got to tell you this. I've seen men come, seen men go. Some of them live, some of them die. The guys that survive this situation, the guys that can tap into sources of strength and power greater than themselves." He said, "You have to have courage. You have to have integrity. We're honest with ourselves and with each other."
And then the peace was signed, and the prisoners of war were going home. Plum told his audience about the things he had planned upon his return to his wife, the meals, the Christmas decorations, all the things he had thought about that would become reality. But that was not to be.
The day finally came. The day the Tulsa were going home. The war ended. We traded 10,000 of those guys for 591 of us. I got on a big old airplane in Hanoi, North Vietnam, and 90 minutes later, I was putting these feet on free soil, Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines. Ran down the ladder of that airplane and across the tarmac to the first phone I could find to call her. Tell her the good news. But she had gone. I called my parents back in Kansas. What's happened to my wife? I'll never forget my mother's words, bless her soul. Mom said, "Son, I'd give 10 years of my life if I didn't have to tell you this. Your wife hung on for 5 years, and just 3 months ago, she filed for divorce. She's engaged to another guy." I spent the next 2 weeks at Great Lakes Naval Hospital near Chicago, rehabilitating. But I felt strong, you know. I just overcome this big problem. What do I do now? But I had that figured out, too. I'm going to go to some little town in the middle of nowhere where they've never heard of Charlie Plum. And if they have, I'll change my name. Because I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to forget that 6 years of pain. And then we had a little press conference in the basement of that hospital. I was the first guy back to the Midwest, and so everybody wanted to know my story. And so I was surrounded by 100 photographers and reporters, and I told my story. On the way back up to my hospital room, just as the elevator doors closed, this young reporter sneaked in. I was nose to nose with this guy. Lines of anguish in his brow and tears in his eyes, and he said, "Mr. Plum, you really got to me in there. Man, I've had a miserable year. My family's falling apart. My job is terrible." He said, "I even wondered if I wanted to go on living." He said, "You've given me hope. You've given me hope." I suddenly decided that there was value in this story of adversity and the telling of it. So I wrote a book, my autobiography, I'm No Hero, and I started to promote that book. And I found that, yeah, there was a lot of connection between the challenges I faced and the challenges of daily life.
Plum spoke for 45 minutes. I've been able to use about 20 minutes here. Post a note on the Weed All About It Facebook page if you'd like to hear Plum's entire presentation, or email me at weedallaboutit, that's W-A-A-I, at wagrains.org, and I'll send it to you. Until next time, I'm Scott Yates, hoping you'll tune in again.